Welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Hello, Chicago, and welcome to another electric episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Well, coming up on today's podcast, we are very excited to have a great phone interview with Neil LaBute. That's right, you heard me, playwright Neil LaBute is on today's show. Aren't you glad you're listening? Also, Tom Williams will be bringing us another audio review, and of course, as always, Chicago's theater news. So, sit back, relax, and get ready to talk some theater. Hello, Chicago, and welcome to another episode of Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of October 16th, 2006. Well, tickets for The Color Purple will be available to the general public this Friday, October 20th. This will be the national tour of the Broadway hit musical, which will be showing at the Cadillac Palace Theater starting in April. So on this Friday, October 20th, you need to head on over to the Cadillac Palace Theater box office. Tickets will be available starting at 9 o'clock online at Broadway in Chicago or by calling Ticketmaster. Otherwise, tickets go on sale at the box office at 10 o'clock. The Color Purple, which opened on Broadway, received 11 Tony Award nominations, including a nomination for Best Musical. And as many of you know, The Color Purple is being co-produced by Chicago's own Oprah Winfrey. So rearrange your schedules, everybody, because on Friday morning, those tickets are gonna go fast. Well, with Halloween almost around the corner, what better way to get into the Halloween spirit than seeing one of the many haunted shows now playing on Chicago stages? This year, audiences can check out many spooky productions such as Theater Hike's Frankenstein, or you could see Rogue Theater's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Perhaps you may want to check out Metropolis Performing Arts Center's Halloween Homicide or Oracle Theater's Disturbed. But of course, you cannot miss Annoyance Theater's Splatter Theater. These are just some of the many Halloween shows going on this fall. For a complete list of the shows, click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section to find out more information. And since we are talking about tickets and holiday shows, remember, Christmas is coming up very soon, and tickets for the Christmas Classics are going quick. Don't forget that tickets are now on sale for A Christmas Carol at both the Goodman Theater and the Metropolis Performing Arts Center, Christmas Schooner at the Bailiwick Repertory Theater, The Nutcracker by the Joffrey Ballet, and Radio City Christmas Spectacular. So you need to start making plans for your holiday shows right now. And here's another reminder for you that Patti LuPone will be coming to Chicago with her triumphant one-woman show, Coulda Woulda Shoulda, and she will be performing with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra on November 14th. Patti LuPone will be doing this as part of an annual benefit concert for the Jewish Community Centers of Chicago. Tickets are approaching sold out for this show, so this is just a reminder, get out there and get your tickets and go see Patti LuPone, who, incidentally, as a little side note, is working on a musical with Chicago's David Mamet. That's right, David Mamet is writing a musical starring Patti LuPone. I just thought you may want to know that. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in your ears. So until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here's my review of Fat Pig by Neil LaBute. Fat Pig by Neil LaBute, directed by Joe Jaharis at Profiles Theater in Chicago. Powerful and realistic look at our aversion toward fat people. Neil LaBute's marvelously written play dramatizes our aversion to fat people in our slim, youthfully oriented society. This bitingly funny romance involves a good-looking guy who falls in love with a plus-size woman. Tom, played by Daryl W. Cox, is a spinelessly weak personality who can't ever tell what's on his mind or be honest because he is overwhelmed by peer group pressure. Tom wants a soulmate, and when he finds Helen, played by Deborah Hurst, a plus-size woman at peace with herself and a kind, nurturing person whose only requirement she wants from a man is honesty. These two have a wonderful romance that is epic in true love until Tom decides to hide her from his peers since he really isn't comfortable with her size. Carter, played by Eric Berger, is the sharp-mouthed, arrogant office gossip who hates fat people and pressures Tom to stay one of the boys. When he and Jeannie Ann, played by Katie Crawford, discover Tom has fallen in love for a fat woman, they insult him. Jean Ann is the self-absorbed person, and she accuses Tom of falling in love with a fat girl just to insult and hurt her since they one time had a romance going. Carter preaches that ultimately Tom is one of the pretty people, and he belongs with the young and slim. Deep down, Tom agrees, despite his strong desire to be with Helen. LaBute has captured the essence of characters strongly controlled by office peer group pressure, where the images require that only the young and the slim are beautiful people. LaBute aptly defines the gutless, weak personality of the male people-pleaser, played by Tom, and the cruel, judgmental Carter. Without giving away plot twists, LaBute offers a snapshot of the influence of a person's weight on human relations, both direct and indirect. This is a smart, telling drama with comic elements. Daryl W. Cox and Deborah Hurst give compelling performances filled with realism and passion. This is an important contemporary play that dramatizes our discrimination against fat people. My rating on the show is recommended. It is at Profiles Theater, which is located 4147 North Broadway in Chicago. The running time is 100 minutes with no intermission. The tickets are $20 to $25. For more information, call 773-549-1815. That's 773-549-1815. And thank you for listening, and remember, go see a play this week.
Listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I'm your host for this week's segment, Ann Nicholson Weber, and I'm talking today to writer and director Neil LaBute. Two of Neil's plays are currently in production in Chicago. One is Fat Pig, which is playing at Profiles Theater in a hit production, and The Shape of Things is being produced by Letting Go Theater at the Athenaeum, and that opens tomorrow. And then in New York, Neil's newest play, which is called Rex, W-R-E-C-K-S, is a one-man show starring Ed Harris, and that opened just last night at the Public in a production that Neil directed himself. And given what must be a very busy schedule, we're extremely grateful that Neil made time for us this morning. So thank you, Neil, for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Since it just premiered last night in a major production in New York, I imagine you're still thinking about Rex, and maybe we could start there. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what the challenges are of writing a one-man show. A 75-minute extended monologue is what I gather the piece is.
Happily talk about that. It's funny, though, you know, when you think that, yes, that's what would be on my mind, but it's strange that they all become things that you look out for and are protective of and care about. You know, I do look at the information that people send on or reviews from the show in Chicago, the Fat Pig production, or something in Germany, and you give them equal weight and you know, care how it's going, at least for the company doing it. You hear people say, "Oh, they're my children," and all of that, and you kind of I tend to scoff and think, "Oh, that's kind of silly." And then you find yourself acting exactly like a parent over them. So it's strange how they become they remain active. But Rex certainly is on my mind because it did open yesterday, and I just came from directing that as well. So there's a different kind of connection when you spent that time so closely with the actor, because when I do work as primarily just a writer in a production, I'm very careful not to direct because people do know that I do that, and so I try to work directly with the director rather than you know, give any kind of sense of blocking or anything to the actors. Mm-hmm. Other than what's on the page. So when I've directed this and you've directed something that's as small and concentrated as a one-man show, you really do make a certain kind of connection with that actor. And I suppose it's the same kind of connection in writing it. You know, you're in that one voice entirely. So everything you're telling is from that perspective, and you're trying to be completely true to that one person's vision and in this case, remembrance of a life spent with another person, because it primarily deals with a married life. A wife has passed away, and a man is telling us their story. It ultimately concentrates on the marriage, although we learn a great deal of his entire life. But that the monologue is a different animal. You know, it's a great tool as a writer, and it's one that I've always been drawn to. But I've written a handful of things just entirely in that form, and I always like it. It's great to watch somebody who really connects with it and becomes that person so singularly, and then can grab us through performance by just connecting with their voice and who they are. And in this case, I'm extremely lucky having Ed Harris do it, who is an amazing presence as just a person, but on stage he's really electric and he carries it quite magnificently. And it's just a very nice meld of material and actor, not someone that I wrote the piece for, but now it's hard to imagine somebody else doing it.
Right. Kind of becomes indelibly his. Well, when you have fewer elements to play with as a writer when you're doing a monologue. I mean, you don't have the rhythm of bringing someone else in. You don't have the different rhythm of a number of actors on stage interacting at the same time. You've just got one mode. Is that something you have to work against somehow to keep an evening moving forward or keep the audience engaged?
I suppose, you know, I guess it's instinctual in some way, because I certainly, as a director, am trying to take what I see on the page and make it, whether it's mine, you know, whether I've written it or somebody else's, and try and make it fluid and organic to what's happening. And reading even some early reviews, they seem to be you know, very happy with Ed's work and split in a way that I usually have come, you know, become accustomed to. Mm-hmm. In terms of either liking what I'm doing as a writer or taking me to task. But as a director, they seem to also like pretty much the way that I've dictated the evening to work and try and make it, you know, have some dynamism that belies the fact that there is just that one person and that they are talking. The difficulty with a monologue is that you can sometimes get into the trap of it being reflection, and that, because you're in a vantage point of being safe, you know, you've lived through an incident or that sort of thing, you can often be looking back on it and telling it in a way that doesn't have a lot of activity to it. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's always trying to make that monologue as active as possible, that one is reliving that moment or still driven by a passion. In this case, it's a kind of confession of sorts. And so there's the very active ingredient of letting that slowly build up and come out of you.
There's a suspense in the way you let out information.
There is, yes. There's the notion that I'm going to tell this, I'm trying to tell this, but I don't. You know, it's the word need as opposed to want. It's I need to get this out, and as hard as it's going to be, I will find little ways to let the steam escape, and then finally, you know, the truth will out itself. But it's something that is often fueled by the actor as well. You know, you really, it depends on how they engage. And in this case, there's not a fixed point of reference for them that they're dealing with. You know, Ed is breaking the fourth wall and dealing with a thrust theater. So he's got an audience on three sides, and he's really excellent at communicating with those people, making a connection with them. Mm-hmm. And so that helps a great deal in telling that kind of story.
Well, when you made the choice to direct a new text, it seems to me you're taking a certain kind of risk, because generally if a director works with the playwright on a premiere, you have some kind of reality check from the director on your work as a writer. And now by having taken on both roles, who takes on that role? Who helps you kind of see how it's landing? Or
that's an interesting question, because you're very right about that. I find that the idea of, like, I can change hats and just become the director is kind of an absurd one. You know, I if anything, I just reinforce what I feel like as a writer. And so I have less people in the room whom I can trust, because I trust myself. But there are fewer people there who are questioning the text or coming up with new ideas or that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that in the times that I've worked with directors, or at least, you know, what I consider really good directors, you know, seasoned directors, I tend to rewrite more when I'm working with another director. And I think it comes directly from the idea that there's that extra set of eyes and ears and another brain that is concentrated on the material and asking good, pertinent, you know, questions. I think that here you trust who you have, and that is your assistant director and your stage manager and the actor, you know, in this case, the actor himself. Now with Ed, again, I've got someone who I don't just know works in the material, but I know his work overall as an actor, and I get to know him as a person and see how, you know, smart he is about what works for him, but also what just works on stage and what works, you know, for this character. Ultimately, he knows far more about this person than I do, you know, and he starts to ask questions that I think, wow, I don't know, and, you know, I hadn't really thought about that, or he'll come in with the eulogy that I only mention, and he's written the eulogy, you know. And there's words that he whispers to his wife at the end of her life that I have no idea what it is that, you know, and I don't ask that question of him. That's his private thing. So so he owns a character in a way that I never can. You know, I create a blueprint that I hope is a sound one and that, you know, has a certain language and voice to it. But he really, you know, becomes that person and becomes the conduit to the audience. And manifests a real human being there who can take what are sometimes on the page very caustic or challenging ideas and make them human. So I have great faith in his gifts. But on top of that, I also know that he's a director, you know, and so I trust his instincts there as well. So he becomes really that bounce board, you know, and so where that place where my work ends and his begins in a case like this becomes even murkier, I think. You know, it really becomes a kind of conglomeration of our thoughts together.
Well, do you feel that you do do you do a better job of realizing your own vision than someone else?
Yes, but I qualify that. I put a big old asterisk next to that, and that is because I do believe that I have a vision. That sounds like I don't believe they have a vision, and I do think so. What I mean by that is that, rightly or wrongly, I have a certain production in my head, and when I'm directing, that's often what I'm headed toward. Now, I may see a design for a set or, you know, get ideas from actors or from a costume designer that alters that somewhat, you know, because everybody's hopefully collaborating on this and not just, you know, going through the motions of fulfilling my desires. I'm saying, oh, well, I know exactly what that costume should look like, and I really want the set to be this. When you hire people, you hope that you're hiring people who have ideas, and so they're manifesting that as well. But I have some sense of not a quintessential production, it's just a production in my head. So I'm good about fulfilling that, you know, rather than translating that to somebody else, because again, if someone else is going to interpret that show, if I go to New York and I work with Joe Bonney or you know, Joe Mantello or George Wolfe, I'm not going to say, I want you to do the version that I have in my head. Right. I've put down on the page what was important to me, and that becomes their interpretation of that.
Right.
So I feel very strong and good about what they've done and know that they will come up with something that's quite interesting. I may then go back to a play at some other point, and that may happen soon with, like, Fat Pig, for instance. I'm trying to take that to London. And if I direct that myself, it will be not like, well, now here's the version that really is perfect and this is the one it should have been. It's just a version that I had in my head.
Although I would imagine that having seen someone else's direction of it, you may learn things about the text you didn't even know.
Oh, God, yeah. There's stuff that you'll steal, you know, entirely.
Right.
and things that have blossomed from that. Absolutely. And then you'll get into a place where you think, oh, I don't know how to do it differently now.
Mm-hmm.
After they, you know, they,
right.
they've done it in a way that I didn't have in my head, and I think it's actually better than what I had in my head. So
right.
am I going to now borrow that, or what am I going to do?
Do you fight against it to
make
it your own?
Yeah, you kind of fight against that impulse,
right.
because I feel like there are certain things, like there was a bit in Fat Pig, and I don't know if this production yet, but there are certain things that Joe brought to that play. One, two that just spring to mind. She opened the play with the actress, the Helen character, the kind of titular character on stage and eating, you know,
uh-huh.
standing in the restaurant before the show proper really had opened, as the audience came in, and just reading her book like she's on her lunch break and reading and eating, and it became very uncomfortable for an audience. And I thought, well, that was a really clever idea, and gave you a real sense of this person. And what her routine was.
Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly, the same thing happens in the Profiles production, although to some degree I think it was a necessity of the setup of the theater. It's pretty hard to bring someone on and start the show given the setup there. But if you do get a chance to see the Chicago production, which I think you would be very gratified to see, that element, in fact, is there. Maybe there's something about the text that asks for that. I don't know.
Well, it's she's certainly there on stage first and all that, so it's something that I think naturally you would see. But the length of time that
uh-huh.
Joe did it really made me excited by her choice there.
I see.
The same way that she built in a, and really for necessity in terms of a scene change, but she built in a lovely little moment before the last scene, which ends on a beach. And it was a bit where Helen was trying on different outfits and trying to decide, you know, what's going to look acceptable or good at the beach. And it was kind of a heartbreaking little bit,
mm-hmm.
But wasn't in the text. And just something that, I thought, you know, I could, I suppose, take that and put it into the text. But it really felt like that's Joe's, and so it's not mine to take.
Uh-huh,
and so
right.
I haven't put it in. And any time that I've heard of it being in there, I figure that people have either seen the show or they read about that somewhere, because it didn't come from me.
Uh-huh, interesting.
So it's those kinds of things, you know, you go, wow, that was a really clever take on that. And still today, you know, I'll see a version of Bash and go, wow, that was a great read on that line. I never thought of it that
mm-hmm,
way. You know,
mm-hmm.
the way that you use the inflection on that particular word. So that's the exciting bit of theater, you know. You these shows come and go, and yet somebody, you know, 10 years later has an interpretation that's really valid and interesting and something you never thought of.
Well, you're produced a lot, as my little litany at the beginning demonstrates. Are you able to go around and see many productions? How do you decide whether to go chase down a production?
You know, it's often just happenstance. I'll be in London, and I read in Time Out that there's one, you know, taking place above a pub, and I'm like, you know, that would be really interesting to go see that that production of Bash, and I'll slip in and see it. And sometimes the director, you know, the last time I did that, a director kind of came walking downstairs and saw me and looked at me for a long time, and then I saw him disappear back upstairs, and then he came back down. He's like, "Oh my God, are you coming to the show?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm coming to see the show." And he's like, "Wow, I'm not going to tell the actors because that'll throw them off, because the space was just, you know, small and really intimate." But, you know, they were surprised by the fact that I would show up at that. And then, you know, there might be a bigger production. I get a lot of productions in say, Germany for some reason. There's just a number of productions of my shows there and at big state theaters. But I won't necessarily see many of those just because of the proximity to me. You know, I'm not in Europe enough to run over and see them all the time.
So. Are those performed in English?
No, they're performed in, they've been translated and performed in German.
I see. Well, to talk about Fat Pig a little, since that is one of the productions of your plays that Chicago audiences can see right now, I imagine you wrote that in 2004, is that right?
Yes, that's when it was produced anyway. So, yeah, it was sometime in that year, I think I wrote it, yes.
And so you perhaps have a little bit of distance from it now that you wouldn't have had when it was being produced at Manhattan Class. Are there things now that you think, wow, I really hit that, or conversely, ooh, I never quite solved that problem?
Oh, there's always that. You know, that's. But, you know, I'm someone who doesn't just stop at that. I'll go back and I'll tinker. You can find various versions of my plays that have been published by Faber, because sometimes they will put a show out, or a text rather, out on the market to coincide with a production, and that's a text that does not reflect all the rehearsal and changes that might go on for a production. So when they reprint, if I'm lucky enough to get a reprint, then I'll put those pages in or make changes accordingly. And just sometimes seeing something, like when I was preparing to take the show to London, there's a part in the play, Jeannie, the co-worker of Tom, who was a former girlfriend as well, I felt like, you know, there's something else I want her to say. I want to give her something more at the end of the play, because I realized that I wasn't unfair to her, but I put her in a difficult position because she learned something about someone that she likes, this guy Tom, very early on in the show. I mean, literally a couple of lines into her entrance, and it alters the way that she is, I think, throughout the show, and our perception of her. Certainly, she's very single-minded in her pursuit and anger throughout the show, but because she's been thrown this curveball of Tom is going out with somebody else. And so I wanted to see her in the end, where she was kind of back at the top of her cycle of dating, you know, and feeling good about herself, and where she could kind of honestly say how she felt about, you know, what is the time that she spent with Tom. And so that's something that isn't in the production that you're seeing in Chicago. It's something that I've kind of held in reserve. I want to use in London, and then I'll probably end up putting it, you know, into a published version at some point. So, usually it's not that I feel something is unfinished. It's just that I'll go back to it, or I'll have a new idea. But occasionally, yeah, I think, oh, you know, I never really got that speech or that phrase, or and if I feel strongly enough about it, then I'll end up going back, or I'll write, you know, something for a new production that simply because a director says this worries me. I had that happen with a play called This Is How It Goes. It had a nice, successful production at the Public Theater, and then just after that went to London, and the director came to me and said, there's just one scene that I have a problem with because they sit at this table the whole time, and I'm going to be in a thrust setting, and I worry that, you know, people are just going to be looking at the back of one of these characters for, you know, 10 minutes. And I said, well, let me think about that, and I came up with a way to play the scene out of doors and give it a whole new spin. And that was interesting to me, so I said, here, you know, and that's not published or anything like that. So it's just a bit of material that someone used, but I have now. If somebody else is interested in it or hears about it, you know, and maybe I'll put that into the published version down the line. So it's that kind of thing that I tend to do. Is it's not that I'm not ever satisfied. It's just that I continue to, you know, go back and think about these things.
Yeah. Well,
apparently, I have no other life, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
In Fat Pig, the protagonist, whose name is Tom, falls in love with an overweight woman. You sort of referred to these circumstances, and then has to struggle with a conflict between his internal reality, his experience of her, how he sees her, and their relationship, and an external view of it. And it occurred to me that that is a struggle that any artist has in an ongoing way. And it made me wonder, you know, when you get your cup of coffee and you go in your study and you sharpen your pencils or you warm up your word processor or whatever you do, and then you sit down, you know, who comes and sits on your shoulder and whispers in your ear, and what do they say, and how do you evict them?
You know, you just have to. There's no way around it. I try to not be very judgmental about what I'm writing. You know, I'll go back and I'm good at rewriting and working on material. I somewhere along the line somebody instilled a good work ethic in mm-hmm. me, and I know that this business that I do is ultimately still all about sitting down and facing whatever machine you use, whether it's by hand or, you know, through a computer, and stacking the pages up one by one. So I kind of have to just live with that. You know, you can come off great reviews or bad reviews, and I try not to believe any of them, and just carry on with what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't let that outside world dictate too much of what I want to do. Because if you smell a hit, you might be tempted to write in that vein again, or if you think, oh, they didn't like that, I've got to, you know, I try not to cater very much. The people that I'm really responsible to, and that I guess ultimately I care most about and am always true to, are those characters on the page, you know, and that's what leads to sometimes the plays ending in what I think of as relatively realistic, but sometimes unfulfilling ways for an mm-hmm. audience, you know, mm-hmm. at least for their expectations, that things do not always end happily or the way they wished. And Fat Pig is certainly the case. I mean, you know, in many ways, I think of Fat Pig as, even though I find the ending sad, I find it quite truthful and actually, you know, honest, and which is the very thing that Tom is asked throughout the play by two very different women. He's asked just to be honest, to be a, you know, an honest person, and in the end he finds that within himself
mm-hmm.
to be honest, but through his honesty he I think hurts somebody, but also realizes that he's not a very strong person.
Yeah.
You know, he realizes that, and that's, I think, a terribly sobering thing to find out about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's not that you're a bad person, it's just that you're not a strong person, and that you can't stand up for yourself, and that's, I think it would be a very hard, and particularly for a man, it's a hard thing to admit.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where I saw Tom was. You know, it's not the end of Tom's life. It's not, you know, I rarely ever write characters who die or that sort of thing. So, you know, I don't think of it as hopeless. You know, these people could change. Who knows? But I write about a very specific portion of their life.
Mm-hmm. Well, you sound, I have to say, to me, surprisingly confident that you are able to kind of clear the decks and just listen to the characters, because a lot of writers I know do talk about how hard it can be to sort out, you know, what's kind of a pure artistic impulse from what is an anticipation of how it's going to land on an audience, which is part of your art. I mean, you are manipulating an audience. So, I mean, in a good way. I mean, artistically, you're using...
Well, I haven't always done it in a good way.
Okay.
But that, I absolutely agree with that. That yes, that connection with the audience is vital. And but I hope it never gets to the point of pandering to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, you know, in a way, they would see through that, and that they would, you know, that they would not appreciate it. I think if anything, they begrudgingly sometimes, but they respect the fact that I'm you know, single-minded often in my purpose
mm-hmm.
about, you know, I have not a worldview, but a you know, a kind of a vision, a voice that I'm perpetrating. Interesting choice of words, but that it really, you know, I do have a certain thing that I'm setting out to do as a writer, and I have to be true to that rather than what I think they might like. I think, you know, if I ultimately make myself happy, that some sort of audience will follow suit with that.
Well, and in fact, you have, by any playwright standards, a lot of success. I mean, you're controversial, but you also are produced a lot, which is great.
I've had a number of productions already in my life, and in this world, this theater world, anyway, it gets harder and harder to have that happen. You know, there's so many readings and the relative costs of putting a show on. So, I consider myself lucky to be working in the field that I wanted to work in.
Right.
You know, and so you get very little from me in the way of complaining.
Well, what's the most gratifying kind of response that you can get or have gotten to your work?
You know, the best response I can get and hope for is what you'll see sometimes outside of a theater, that you'll, you know, even recently with Rex, to see, you know, to have finished a show and gone up and talked to the actor and given notes and you decide, hey, let's go grab a drink afterwards, and you wander outside and there are people still in the lobby or out on the street and they're talking mm-hmm. about the show. That it has had this kind of influence, this sphere of influence that goes beyond their experience in the play,
mm-hmm.
or that they've gone, you know, you go to the restaurant and there's another group at the restaurant and they're talking about it, and somebody comes over and asks you, say, I just want to ask you one question about that.
Uh-huh.
That's an exciting thing.
Yeah.
Or to have even, you know, a friend, you know, say, guess I'm still thinking about that a week later, and I feel like this is what was going on. That's in an age where people, you know, go through the media voraciously, you know, and use up, you know, I see three movies a weekend and I read this book and I move on to this magazine, and, you know, to have any sense of having staying power mm-hmm. with an audience, whether they like it or not, whether they love it, it's, you know, I think some response, some sense that wow, I really like that, I really hated that, is far better than just being some disposable thing that they empty and move on from. So I'm actually happy when I know that I've connected in that way, that just some words that I heaped on a page, an actor is able to take and communicate to somebody and create something that feels alive enough for them to care about. Not mm-hmm. to say, well, I know that was, you know, just Ed Harris standing up on the stage. I know that was Daryl Cox, you know, acting. But, you know, for a minute there, I really cared about that girl and him. I hope that I wanted that relationship to work out. I wanted this guy to tell me the truth about his wife. You know, that's fairly gratifying, I would say.
Yeah. You get your hooks in.
That's all you can hope to do, ultimately. I mean, I'm very skeptical of the idea that, you know, a play I write is going to change the world or the way people think. But it may give them some other view or just raise questions that I find worth asking. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not someone who thinks I have these questions and then I have an answer for you. I want to shove my answer down your throat. Usually you raise these questions because you don't know the answer.
Do you sometimes find an answer as you write about them?
I find an answer for me. That's often the case. But I'm not so bold as to think this is everybody's answer. I'm a big student of subjectivity and relativity and feel like, you know, my answer may not be everybody else's answer.
Well, that's kind of the playwright's stock in trade, I think, that empathy. You can't write well if you can't completely put yourself in someone else's point of view, at which point how can you say my point of view is the only one that matters?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, if anything, you come to find that you know, we're all such different drummers, and that, you know, I mean, Robert Frost, he absolutely must have seen me wandering out on that road, because, you know, nobody wanders down a much stranger or singular path than myself. But that's me thinking of myself, and everybody, I think, feels the same way about themselves. So it's ultimately, how can I have some universal truth? I write about something very specific, and you hope that it has resonance for people. But it's, you know, it's not gonna save the world. It's just going to make people hopefully look up and say, well, maybe there's another way to look at this.
Do you think there's something in the zeitgeist, something about where we are culturally, that that is part of the big response that your work tends to get?
I, I think it's a time of many questions for people, of great uncertainty, you know, but if you go back in history, it's probably always been that. There's probably always been those big questions on the minds of people. Maybe sometimes they are greater, and the times feel a bit more tense. It seems to be that now, but I think that, you know, people, and that's one of the great things that we've always questioned. That's why we push further and further. There's negative aspects that come with that as well. But I think that, you know, at our best, our questioning leads to, you know, to new truths.
A lot of your truths seem to be kind of bitter.
I'm a realist, if nothing else. Uh-huh. You know, I'm definitely skeptical of how, you know, how we live our lives and how we treat each other. I think that we so often take the slightly easier route that is filled with self-interest, you know, and that's usually at the cost of somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm aware of the great good and the great bad that we can find ourselves doing, and so I think that it's much more interesting to write the bad. I have to pitch characters into conflict, you know,
right,
to create drama, and so I'm often looking for the bad where it may not even exist yet. I'm taking a situation that could have gone along just fine. A group of friends who, you know, were perfectly happy until I came along
and pushed them off into the abyss.
Pushed one of them off off the edge of the cliff, and then pointed a finger at somebody else.
Uh-huh.
And said it was their fault. So, you know, I'm a rabble rouser on the page. You know, I'm pretty quiet, you know, easy to get along with, relatively hopeful person as a individual, but on the page, I'm always looking to mix it up.
Well, actors have talked to me about what it can be like to live in a character's skin, and particularly if you're doing a really evil character, for instance, it can be very wearing to protect yourself against that. And you do tend to write about often rather unpleasant people, or weak people anyway. Does it affect you? Is that something that you have to in some way protect yourself against when you've spent all this time in your study with these somewhat icky people?
I suppose that there's some of that, you know, that you do want to escape it from time to time. But I'm very clear in my head anyway about, you know, this is fiction and this is life. And I'm far more upset by reading the newspaper than I am by reading or, you know, any of the writing that I do.
Right.
You know, I'm very aware and healthy about, well, that's just, you know, that's just fiction. It's outlandish what they say and crazy, and thank God it's not real. But it is just a, you know, a piece of writing, and those people don't exist. And I'm always more shocked by watching the headlines,
over which you also have no control,
exactly,
unlike your characters.
Absolutely, and you think, you know, these are real people who are doing things that are so much more breathtaking than what I'm coming up with. It doesn't take me long to kind of have to scurry back into my room and say it's much safer in here.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you start a new play, is there anything that you say along the lines of, okay, now this time I'm going to something or other, or this time I'm not going to?
You know, it seems like it's rarely at the beginning. I rarely set out with such kind of measured plans as now I'm going to write this or a comedy or go in a completely different direction. I often find myself, you know, thinking about an idea a lot and then sitting down and writing, and it starts to take shape, and then I'll go back and you know, kind of fill in the seams as I go, that I'll suddenly see a structure in the thing that I didn't see before.
Mm-hmm.
Say, oh, I see. Okay, so this is going to be every two scenes I'm going to have a big monologue in between, and then I'm going to, you know, and that'll create the balance there, or actually every scene is going to open with this line of dialogue. Or I'm going to have these four scenes, and they're all going to take place in hotel rooms, but there'll be different hotel rooms, a different woman, and each of those women will have a what could be a man's name, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of thing often just shapes itself as you're going along. It's not always, I don't have it plotted out, you know, before I start writing always.
Well, I guess I'm asking something else, which is, as an artist, is there something you're striving towards?
So a bigger thing, you mean? I don't think there is. I think that, you know, while people have now seemed to feel that they could say this has a quality of your kind of writing, or you know, this all seems of a piece, or worse, they'll point a finger and say, haven't you already done this before? Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. I think you know, you can see a thread of themes and style and a kind of voice there, but I think I'm still looking for, you know, something that will surprise and entertain in a way that you know, you haven't seen from me before. That I'm looking for new forms or whatever, to keep people, not just guessing, but keep people coming back and saying that, you know, I can't just see one of these and feel like, yeah, you know, if you've seen one of his plays, you've seen them all.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody may still say that, but at least from my point of view, I'm saying, I'm trying to do something that's different every time I go to bat.
But you're pushing yourself.
Well, I can't find anybody else to push me. So
right.
It's pretty much a lonely vigil.
The production of Fat Pig is the second one of your plays that Profiles Theater here in Chicago has done in the last year. What do you think is interesting them in your work, and does that lead to some kind of relationship between you and the company?
I think so. I'm actually a pretty what's the word? I must not be it completely, or I would know it more specifically. I'm very good about sticking with people, being faithful, I think when I find a home, I'm good about going back there. It's certainly the case in London. I've worked with a couple of places repeatedly, and certainly in New York with the Public Theater and MCC. And I think what I saw just within the last calendar year with Profiles, and certainly a connection I made with Daryl Cox, was just that, you know, people who, and I think that was the connection I made originally with Chicago and theater and new writing in particular, is that it's always been a good home for material that wants to push, you know, against the norm and say there's other things I want to do here and create some sort of vital, interesting voice. I started out after college working in Chicago, and I think that seeing, you know, a group like Profiles that continue, just also seeing the other kinds of work that they're doing like Rebecca Gilman and mm-hmm. and are interested in what the playwright has to say. And I think the fact that it's nice to be liked or wanted, and so the fact mm-hmm. that they you know, responded to Audubon and then to Fat Pig, and I think other plays they've asked for other work, and I've talked about doing more with them. That's always gratifying, but it's not just that; it's the results as well. You know, it's knowing that they do find a connection with that material and with the voice that I have, and so you feel in good hands. Basically, you feel like you're safe, and that the work will be nurtured in the right way. So I think that, you know, the easiest way to respond to that is that it's just you know it when you see it, and you can tell when you're being well taken care of.
Well, you're right about that. I mean, the critical response to Fat Pig has been fantastic, and I think the audience is plainly, I mean, they've added performances, and it's really a hit here, and that has a lot to say, obviously, about the production as well as about the play. Well, thank you, Neil. You've given us a lot of time, and I really do appreciate it.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much, and I think this is a great new way to get the word out for an art form that's been around a long time, but, you know, people keep saying it's dying out, and I'm pretty skeptical about that as well. I think theater is, you know, is here to stay, and the people will continue to see how unique and particular and just, you know, in the end, how that form, that connection that a piece of theater makes with an audience is unlike anything else out there. And so that's why it will continue to not just survive, but to thrive.
Well, I certainly agree with you. Thanks so much, Neil.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, thank you very much for listening to this electric episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. But before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote comes from Henry IV, Part 1, Act 4, Scene 3. Greatness knows itself. Well, we can't thank you enough for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Mote, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.